and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted to have on the program this week Mary Kay Lombino, Curator of Collections at the Francis Lehman Loeb Arts Center, who's here to talk with us about the exhibition, her exhibition, The Polaroid Years, Instant Photography and Experimentation, that just opened this past Friday and will run through June 30th of this year. Welcome, Mary Kay. It's great to have you back.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Judging by the crowd at the opening this past Friday, this looks like it's already a very popular exhibition, and I wonder if this is in part because people still remember their Polaroid cameras or their parents' Polaroid cameras, and that those of us for whom this was a sort of ubiquitous way of making images before digital photography came along are just beginning to realize that this part of our common experience is essentially gone. You know, it struck me walking through the show that I was looking at something that I'm still thinking of as contemporary technology, but it's not contemporary technology, especially to young people. So, you know, I wonder, did you mean the show to be a requiem for Polaroid, in part anyway?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because when I really began thinking about the exhibition, it was just after 2008 mm-hmm. when the Polaroid Corporation announced that they were discontinuing production on all of the instant technology, the cameras and the film. And so there already was this sense of nostalgia out in the world. I was reading blog posts about how life wouldn't be the same without this technology anymore. And so there was already sort of a collective nostalgia occurring mm-hmm. out there in the world. And I noticed that some artists were picking up on that and making a conscious decision to go back to that film and that technology, finding either expired film or companies that were beginning to make new film and testing it out for the first time because of this sort of group nostalgia.
The nostalgia is interesting, I think, in part because Polaroid photos were always so intensely about the here and now. They're always the newest technology in a way. You always felt that way. When it came out, it was certainly like that. And then as the new cameras came out and the processes were a little different, you know, you felt
well,
that was the
and
case.
That's what's kind of interesting about something that is so much an icon of its time mm-hmm. is it does become then an icon of the past as soon as you look back 20, 30 years because it's a defining cultural moment or a defining cultural aspect of what we all knew at that time. Mm-hmm. And so while it's the here and now when it exists, it's often the thing with which we remember it most fondly or a particular time.
Yeah.
I think that happens. And I do find also that in particular when it comes to technology, there's a notion that we want to grab onto something that's from the analog world. And Polaroid's being swept up in this whole cult almost for the analog. It's like a backlash to the digital world.
Mm-hmm. The technology is also about the here and now and that it's instant photography.
Right.
Well, I mean, it was very much about the present instant as opposed, say, to conventional film where you might take the photo in the present but you don't get to see it until a week or, you know, in the old days, a couple weeks later sometimes when you got it back from the photo finisher. So there's this instantaneous, even though it wasn't really quite instantaneous.
It wasn't quite instant. In fact, the Polaroid founder, Edwin Land, didn't like to use the word instant. He called it one-step photography.
Interesting.
And then when the SX70 came out, he called it integrated one-step photography mm-hmm. because all of the development happened right there on the print.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that the development process with the Polaroid is really part of the experience of taking the picture, isn't it? And it changes as the cameras change. I remember when you started out, there was a peel-away process, as
That's
I
right.
was remembering, and you had to put a kind of gel on the surface of the old black and white.
Yes, so there's the peel part film, mm-hmm. Which is what they called it. It was kind of a shorthand for the type of film it was. And then there was another where it came with a little squeegee,
yeah.
and you basically pushed the emulsion across the print. There was another very early, this is now 1950s, type of film that some professionals used where you'd actually be out in the field and you would have a little bucket of solution next to you, sort of strung over your shoulder. And you'd take a picture and you would slide it into the solution and it would develop right there while you're out in the field.
Oh.
And if you forgot to put it in there, it wouldn't develop right or it would fade all the way to black.
Oh.
it would overexpose.
An interesting thing about the instantaneity is because it does take place in time, in a sense, and in the early days you had to look at your watch to time the development, it seems to underscore some aspect of what? Instantaneity, I suppose.
There is something about the waiting time mm-hmm. that builds excitement.
Yes, yeah,
in
that's
a way.
True. Yeah.
You've got a minute or so to wait while this thing develops. You have a sense of what it's going to look like, mm-hmm. but until it appears before your eyes, you don't have that aha
yeah.
moment.
And in the old days, you needed another piece of equipment, and that was your watch with
yes.
a second hand on it. I mean, it was important to get it right, timed right.
So one thing that's interesting about some of the new film that's being created today, there's a company called Impossible Project mm-hmm. that makes wonderful films, and they're still perfecting them. But one of them, which they just finished perfecting, you still have to wait 30 minutes. And it says right there on the outside of the package that you should turn it face down mm-hmm. rather than watch it appear before your eyes, and you have to wait 30 minutes. And we are not used to waiting that long in this day and age.
No.
We like our photography completely instant now, so
yeah.
it's a real sense of slowing down.
And then with some of the film, I think it starts with the SX-70. You can actually see the film resolve in front of your eyes slowly.
Yes.
And it has a kind of magical, you know, I mean, apart from the excitement, but it has a kind of magical aspect.
Absolutely. And actually, when Edwin Land was still developing the SX-70 camera, mm-hmm. in-house, they used to call the camera Aladdin because it was magical. And they decided that that name was possibly too playful or whimsical, and they later changed it to SX-70, which refers to his 70th special experiment and sounded much more technical
yeah,
and professional.
Yeah. Well, certainly the Polaroid company itself had a kind of romance about it, mm-hmm. and I think that was in part because it offered this new technology, which is perfectly designed, especially if you look at an SX-70. In fact, I think one of the most beautiful pieces in your show is the SX-70 itself that you have on Walker Evans' own little SX-70
yes,
there.
Yes, with all the leather and chrome. It's very elegant.
Yeah, it is, and small and complex, but well made. And if you've ever held one in your hands, it has a certain weight. It's a little bit like the iPhone. The iPhone is a little monolithic.
That's right.
But it has the same aura about it. It's the latest thing, something you may not have known you wanted until you saw it work. And
absolutely.
Then, you know.
And even like the iPad and how people kind of manipulate that and move it around mm-hmm. and cover it up and it instantly goes to sleep and
yeah.
things like that. Design was very important to Edwin Land. You know, he was a bit of a Renaissance man in that way. Even though he was a scientist and an inventor, really, he held many, many patents in his lifetime. He cared about design. He hired designers to work on these cameras. He even hired designers, Charles and Ray Ames, to do mm-hmm. a little movie to promote the SX-70 camera when it came out.
Yeah.
And so it was clearly on his mind, and it makes him that much more forward-thinking because he was able to promote his own materials that way.
Yeah, and somewhere, either in the catalog or elsewhere, you talk about the fact that the company was about the intersection of culture and technology, in a sense, and that Land was interested in supporting artists, and
yes.
that he hired artists like Walker Evans, actually hired them as technical advisors.
That's right, and he wanted to see what would happen if you stuck a scientist and an artist in the same room with the same problem.
Yeah, basically. That's very interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think it's because he had a little sensibility for each discipline mm-hmm. in himself. And he thought, why not put that into my corporation as well? And it was actually Ansel Adams with whom he became very close.
Mm-hmm.
And he had him giving him all his advice on his black and white film. And shortly after that, he hired Marie Cassindis, who is lesser known, but a wonderful artist who mm-hmm. did some amazing experimentation with the color film.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also on retainer. They were both being paid, you know, a $100 a month kind of fee as consultants,
mm-hmm.
along with other artists, Paul Caponigro, a few other artists who would continually give him feedback on the technology, on the process, on how he can improve things. And he understood the value of that.
And then he started a program in Polaroid to actually purchase art from artists.
It wasn't a purchase, actually. It was a nice kind of tacit trade.
Uh-huh.
So the system didn't have a name at the beginning, but eventually it became called the Artist Support Program.
Mm-hmm.
And he supplied a great deal of film and cameras, in fact, endless supply, to many artists.
Uh-huh.
And they would go out in the world, make their art with it, and then they would give back a number of their pieces to the corporate collection. And that's how the collection grew to, they're not sure exactly how many pieces, but somewhere between 16,000 and 23,000 works of art that the Polaroid Corporation owned at the time of their bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And that was international artists. The number of artists exceeds 1,000, I believe. Mm-hmm. But many of the artists in the exhibition were on the artist support program. They're products of that program. Mm-hmm. And I might not have ever found out about them had I not seen their work in the Polaroid collection.
Oh, interesting. Was there any curatorial staff then working for Polaroid to keep track of these things?
There was. In fact, one of their curators was here for the opening on Friday night,
yes.
Barbara Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a wonderful relationship with many of these artists. And early on, there was a guy named John Holmes who wasn't considered a curator, but his job was basically to help promote this material out into the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And so together with a few other people, that collection was in a way curated, but really it was sort of amassed because it was so much work.
And then how do so many Polaroids end up in our collection
so
in
we
exhibit?
Have, that's because I've been collecting them since I became interested in the material.
So actively.
Foundation. Oh, and then we have this work from the Warhol Foundation of Visual Arts, and that was in 2009 when many museums, in fact, over 180 museums that mostly are connected with campus, you know, either universities or colleges, and they were all the recipients of this great grant, all Warhol photographs, about half black and white and half Polaroid.
Mm-hmm.
And we were part of that, and we received 150 works, and some of the best Warhols in our collection are his photographs.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's great.
Those are some of my favorites, actually.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he took those, at least the portraits, he took them as a sort of precursor to his paintings and prints that he was making of people. And they have a certain similarity in terms of the head and shoulders point of view.
Yeah.
A lot of them wear white makeup. There's a very even lighting. He used to sit them by his window in his studio and use this camera called the Big Shot. And so you can see there's exhibitions that have been happening in the last couple of years at these museums who have recently acquired these works.
Yeah.
And I'm getting to see lots of them as I travel around to see these exhibitions. And altogether, I think there were close to 30,000 photographs made by Warhol in his lifetime.
It's funny because you don't think of Warhol as a photographer particularly.
Exactly. Yeah. But here was this massive body of work that he was doing all along.
Yeah, interesting. And they sort of then serve the function of sketches. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And I was very interested in that when I first came to this material. As many artists use Polaroid technology as a way to map out what they were going to make in other media.
Yeah, it's very interactive in that way.
Yeah.
You wonder if you can do that now with digital just as easily.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, Land seems to have been an astute advertiser and marketer, I mean, apart from being a sort of technological genius.
Absolutely. I mean, and he had a team of great marketers on his staff as well. But it was really his vision that, similar to the way that Apple products are marketed to the sort of creative types, he was interested in that. He had this great campaign in the New Yorker in the 1970s where he would photograph a work of art that an artist made that is now residing in the collection of a major museum, such as MoMA. And the slogan said something like, "Lucas Samaras's work is on view at the MoMA collection. You can take a picture like this too." And sort of, he was really appealing to the feeling that everybody can be an artist.
Yeah. Well, that's ingenious, really, because when you think of it, the skills that make a traditional photographer in the arts, like Walker Evans, have a lot to do with their mastery of the darkroom.
Yes.
But if you don't need to know a lot about developing film, then it's a matter of just getting what you want in the frame and your imagination, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, Robert Mapplethorpe, who's in the exhibition as well, he never felt like he could deal with technology, and he certainly didn't have the patience to be doing his own developing in a dark room.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until the Polaroid technology came his way, and he was part of the artist support program, that he felt like he could even try photography. And then, of course, photography became his major form of art.
Yeah, interesting. So the Polaroid had a huge influence on Mapplethorpe as an artist.
Absolutely.
It made him as an artist.
It made him as an artist, and part of my idea for doing a show on experimentation, mm-hmm. was to show the ways in which Polaroid technology inspired an artist to do something that he might not have ever done mm-hmm. had Polaroid not existed. That was the question I would always ask myself when deciding if an artist or their work should be in the show. I would say, well, if there wasn't any Polaroid, would they have done this? And if the answer was no, then they could be in the show, basically.
So there's the instantaneity that appeals to him, but also the thing about Polaroid is you don't have to send the negatives out to a photo finisher, so it allows for an investigation of sexuality and erotic realism and what you have with Mapplethorpe. And that seems to be part of the pull of the technology for some. For some artists, certainly, they're
not only for artists, but for the general public as well. Yeah. And they're... is an essay in the catalog that's called The Perversity of Polaroid.
Yeah, it's a wonderful essay. Yeah,
it is. Really, it's by Peter Buse, and it's very astute in pointing out the ways in which Polaroid really allowed for artists a certain amount of freedom. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that in the work of Lucas Samaras, mm-hmm. who just spent time in his kitchen wearing only his flip-flops mm-hmm. and taking many, many pictures of himself and then manipulating them. And I just love to picture him running back and forth with his camera. Mm-hmm. And then there are other works. Robert Heinecken deals with a sort of soft pornography mm-hmm. and his student, Jack Butler, mm-hmm. whose work has a similar effect. I think there was a certain freedom that was afforded to these artists having... not to deal with anyone looking at their pictures other than themselves.
Yeah. One of the other things Peter Buse mentions in terms of the technology being perverse in a way is that it sidesteps the course of the production of images in the modern world, and that most photography has always been about reproduction, making multiple copies from the same negative.
Yeah.
But the thing about Polaroid is every shot is a one-of-a-kind object.
Right? That's exactly right. And that is one of the things that sets it so far apart from digital photography, is a digital image is infinitely reproducible, and a Polaroid image is not.
Yeah.
It's a unique object. Yeah.
So what does that mean for our experience of the object as a work of art?
Oh, I think it's huge. Mm-hmm. I think that idea of it being rare mm-hmm. makes it more valuable in our minds, and actually in the art market as well.
Yeah.
The more rare something is, the more valuable it is. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also something about this sort of aura that a unique object has. It goes all the way back to religious relics, mm-hmm. where if a saint has touched a piece of cloth, then it becomes sacred, and there's something about that. There's only one of these in the world, and the artist touched it.
Yes, yeah.
It's quite important.
Yeah, you sense that with the Warhol photos, in particular, because they're just little objects, of course, just the same as you would take. But, Andy Warhol held a camera out in front of his head and took this shot.
So it gets elevated from the status of ephemera to an artwork, basically.
Yeah, interesting. So what did traditional photographic artists like Evans and Ansel Adams, whose work does rely on mastery of the darkroom, as they're conventionally thought of anyway, mm-hmm. what did they make of this instant photography?
Well, in the case of Walker Evans, he really had to backtrack because mm-hmm. he had formerly written about the fact that he had no use for color photography at all. And then along comes the SX-70. Mm-hmm. He had a free one. Yeah. He was old at this point. He was in his 70s. He didn't have the kind of patience or time really to take the same type of pictures he'd been taking most of his life. Mm-hmm. And he was attracted to this camera because he was able to carry it around in his pocket, mm-hmm. and he even describes this moment of being able to pull it out of his pocket, open it quickly, and snap a photograph very quickly and easily. It was a very fluid mm-hmm. activity for him.
Yeah, it was point and shoot, right, the SX-70.
Absolutely.
There wasn't
There's
a lot
no
of calculation.
Focus.
No, yeah, no.
There's nothing. Yeah. And so he loved that, and he sort of waxed poetic about it late in life and changed his mind mm-hmm. about color photography. And Ansel Adams, in a similar way, who made a lot of portraits and nature studies with the SX-70, but he also used the large-scale black-and-white Polaroid technology later in life to do his huge landscapes. Those mm-hmm. are on Polaroid paper.
Oh, interesting.
Many of them are.
Yeah.
And I think he did that just because it had a very high level for detail mm-hmm. because they're direct prints. and it's like using any large format camera.
There's a depth about a Polaroid shot that you don't get in a conventional 35 millimeter.
That's right. There's a depth of field that's definitely larger. A lot of artists talk about that as why they're attracted to the technology.
It makes it, when you see a Polaroid, you know you're not looking at a Kodak image.
That's right. It's unique in that way. And another artist is André Courtège, who had completely given up photography late in life after his wife died, and he was mourning her death when he first encountered the SX70 camera. Graham Nash gave it to him. And he began taking pictures from inside his apartment, looking out the window. And he had these little glass figures that sort of reminded him of himself and his wife. And he did these very romantic still lives. And they were also the first color photography that he ever did.
So, you know, the SX70 comes on the scene in the early 1970s, just as photography itself seems to be coming into its own as a medium. There were, you know, certainly people like Evans who were known as art photographers earlier on, but photography really just seems to explode in this period as a medium and as an experimental medium, and finally breaks with painting altogether.
Yes.
Was Polaroid any more suited, do you think, to specific contemporary movements in the arts and what was going on in the arts generally than conventional film? Or is it just a matter of timing here?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two, actually. I think that the timing was fabulous because the SX70 came out in 72. There had been a real, since the mid-60s, there had been a real shift in photography, leaving this idea that you had to be a technician to make a photograph. And also breaking with a sort of more conventional black and white, typical, you know, what people would know as a fine art photograph, and more moving into a conceptual notion in which the way that you make your art is just sort of a tool to get a point across. So you start with the concept and then you do whatever it takes to realize that concept. That was a new thing, newish at this point. And so the SX70 camera was a great tool for doing that quickly without taking a lot of time to think about necessarily the aesthetics of things, but really as a tool to document things. And a lot of what conceptual art is a documentation of something that happened. So I think it was perfectly timed in that way, and that was serendipitous. It probably was not intentional.
You know, I have in my head images of Polaroid cameras that figured routinely in 80s and 90s police drama. You know, Homicide, NYPD Blue, detectives are always pulling out their Polaroid at a crime scene and taking images, or they use them to take instant mug shots.
That's right.
And photography is generally a documentary medium, but Polaroid prints seem to have this documentary implication especially, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think, again, because it's quick and dirty, you can just take the picture, then it's in your hand, you can show someone right away. Here's the evidence of something that I saw five minutes ago. You know, we actually used to a lot in art museums because we would watch as someone unpacked a certain artwork. You take a picture of it in its crate. You take a picture of someone taking it out of its crate. And those Polaroid pictures would accompany art around the world as a way to show someone how it's supposed to look.
Interesting.
So it was very much used almost as the pencil and paper is as a note taker. And in fact, the largest Polaroid camera ever made, which makes 40 by 80 inch prints, made because it no longer exists, was called the museum camera. And it was invented particularly to photograph paintings and sometimes tapestries that were too large for any other camera to take. And so it was housed at the MFA Boston. And then when artists found out about this camera, they said, well, we need to get our hands on it. And so many artists got to experiment
with
that.
So this was sort of 40 by 80.
And they were direct prints, the largest direct print ever made. Huge, so there's one in the exhibition. It's a self-portrait by Chuck Close. Other artists who used it before it was dismantled were Lucas Samaras, Marie Cassidnis, Catherine Opie. These are all artists in the exhibition who experimented with that large format camera.
So what's interesting about the fact that you have a documentary medium here is that what is documented then is an archival piece more than a library piece, and that it isn't reproducible. It's a one-of-a-kind thing. So if you're going to if you're going to keep it as a document, that's what you got.
Yeah, and also different than digital images where it's hard to tell if someone's manipulated them. So a Polaroid image, if manipulated, you can see how it's been manipulated. So it's, in a way, at least it purports itself to be a direct image of reality.
Mm-hmm. And manipulation seems to be the name of the game with a lot of artists,
absolutely,
doesn't it? And the film seemed to attract that kind of technique. You know, it's malleable in a lot of interesting ways.
That's right. And I think this is also a period when photography and painting and drawing were all beginning to sort of meld into one another.
Mm-hmm.
So painters were picking up this camera, and they already had a penchant for pushing paint around on a canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they were with a photograph where the emulsion was loose enough to push it around as though it were paint.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the artists did that. Some of them turned it over and peeled off the back and painted on the back, and so that you can see through the paint. And some of the small manipulated photographs in the exhibition actually look more like paintings.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of paint included.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Lucas Maris, he used markers.
Mm-hmm.
But there really is the touch of the hand and the gesture.
Yeah, in the catalog you mentioned some of the Polaroid technicians were a little concerned that, you know, people were putting their prints into toasters and freezers. And
they were. They would heat up the film even before they used it.
Yeah.
They would do whatever they could, and that's where the experimentation really gets fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they were getting this film for free. They felt a real freedom for doing whatever they needed to or just playing around with it.
Yeah.
And
there's
very little risk.
Then it lends itself to the sort of mixed media idea. Ellen Carey had a nice quote that you reproduce in the book. Polaroid is an agent of revolution in creative visual thinking, for her anyway, that it does have this revolutionary pull about it.
And it pushed artists, I think, in a direction that was fun and experimental.
So, you know, because the images are one of a kind, a lot of artists seem to hit upon using them collectively as multiples, taking more than one image and then building these up as photomontage or...
That's right. And if you want to make a big composition, starting with a small unit is a great way to do it.
Yeah.
So in the case, let's say, of David Hockney, he was a painter. He's known for his painting. And he began sort of documenting the interior of his home with a camera because he wanted to see instant results. And that led him to this idea of doing a montage where he tiles together several small images of the SX70 square format to create a whole image.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, he would need to go very close to every section of his composition.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have someone's face where he has just the nose or just an eyebrow in each of the portions of that image. But then in the background, probably 40 feet behind where the person's sitting, there might be a bookshelf. And he has to go very close up to each book to take an individual picture of those.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily think of that when you see the entire picture together. You just see a perfectly tiled together image.
Yeah. Is that because of the change in focus?
Yes, and I think there's something with our brains where we will just put it together and make it into a unit in a way that we're used to seeing things as a whole.
Yeah.
And so we don't even see the sum of the parts.
Uh-huh.
We see the whole.
The portrait of David Hockney, you know, you'd call it a self-portrait because someone else must have been holding the camera for some of it.
Exactly.
Yes, but anyway, it's one of my favorite pieces. I mean, large pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
Joyce Nemanis does this also a bit.
That's right. In fact, she did it before Hockney.
Oh, did she?
Which is very interesting because she is an artist who is not very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And the two first galleries of the exhibition I like to call my galleries of the famous and the forgotten.
Uh-huh.
Because there really are some names that, of course, we recognize today. And some who were working right alongside those artists but weren't recognized for whatever reason, sometimes because they were female.
Yeah.
And it was really much more of a man's art world then. But Joyce Nemanis was at the time married to Robert Heineken, who was also experimenting with the SX-70. Mm-hmm. And she came up with the idea of tiling together in a much more ad hoc way than Hockney to create a scene. Now, what's different between her and Hockney's work is that she would often take the background of one scene and the foreground of another and then the central image of a third and push them together and create a scene that didn't happen to already exist before, whereas Hockney's really taking a direct scene and creating an image of it.
Hmm.
So there's something quite different about them. But they were both working around the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her single images I find really just enchanting also. There's something really just beautiful about them.
There is. And there's something about her fine lines and the amount of drawing that she does. You almost don't see the photograph at all.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking a bit earlier before the interview. I tend to gravitate toward the 3x3s rather than the big images. You know, I can see the Chuck Close is quite nice, but there's something about the 3x3s. There's something so precious about them in a sense. And they are single, as we were talking. They're, you know, one-of-a-kind objects. But
And they're iconically Polaroid. I think that's what we think of when we think of the word Polaroid.
Yeah, that's true. So we're used to that format. Those of us that remember the camera anyway, we're used to holding those in our hands. Also in this vein, I really liked the images of, I think my favorite were Andreas Mahl's Polaroid transfer prints, which were manipulated, but they are these small 3x3 objects.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's something ghostly about
them. There is, and I'm not sure how he did that. I think he must have added some solution to it to make it look almost liquid or as though it's an image on fabric that's been folded, and they're really beautiful.
Yeah, he pulls the top layer off and then sort of...
He places it on a plain sheet of white paper.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the small format I was drawn to as well. In fact, I thought about doing a show of only small format, and I was very close to doing that until I realized what amazing technology the large format was and how important it was to many of the artists in the show.
Yeah.
And I decided that there really couldn't be a Polaroid exhibition without using both the large format and the small format.
Yeah, The small format in particular must have been a challenge for Bruce Bundock, your preparator.
Yes.
Just because everything has to be matted and framed, and there's so many of them.
So much matting and framing. And we did make the decision to include several works inside one frame.
Yeah.
So there are these multiple windows in the mat to create a sort of grid of images in some cases, or a strip of images, which I think helps the exhibition be less of just a little postage stamp pictures on a huge white wall.
Yeah.
So I think Bruce did a great job on that.
Yeah. And then one of the people that likes the larger format is Lucas Samaras.
Yes.
And his work, I think, stands out to some extent. And
it does.
I think some of the other artists in the exhibition look to him as a trailblazer.
Absolutely. In fact, I went to Lucas Samaras' studio when I was first researching the project. And he's a very entertaining guy. And he's still working. He makes work actually with Photoshop now.
Oh.
So he continues to manipulate images.
Yeah, he's working with the newest technology.
That's right, so always with the newest technology. And I told him I was doing an exhibition on artists who experimented with the Polaroid. And he said, well, that would just be me. He was convinced that he had to have been, he wasn't only the first, but he was
the
only guy,
yes,
whoever's done anything interesting with the material.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do give him a lot of credit for blazing a trail, as you say, with the manipulation of the images and using the large format Polaroid as well. And there are artists who've told me, you know, I knew what Samaras was doing, and therefore I wanted to try my hand at it as well.
Yeah, and these are not so much photo montage as collage.
Collage, because he cuts the photographs and strips them back together.
Yeah.
You know, Lucas is an interesting guy. His exhibition that was his retrospective at the Whitney was called The Unrepentant Ego.
Uh-huh.
And because his work is really about the self.
Yeah.
And I think the Polaroid technology lends itself to a real navel-gazing activity in which you really can get completely into the self-image. And that's something that he was already had a penchant for, and so it was a perfect match.
So another one of my favorites who works with the 3x3s is James Welling. There's, for me, a kind of odd realism about his chromogenic works, even though they're manipulated a lot, and they're essentially tinted because he manipulates the lens of the camera.
Absolutely, He's been doing experimental work all along, and what I love about the Polaroids in the show by Welling is that he did those when he was just out of graduate school. And he was literally in his studio, and he said he always needed to be near something hot because he would heat up the film, heat up the pictures, which gives them that really warm glow.
Yeah.
And he would just take pictures of the corner of his shower or the corner of his studio or his bicycle and really just looking around his own studio. But that was a precursor to the way that he does photography now, which has been experimental all along.
Yeah.
And he also is important because he is the chair of the photography department at UCLA, which was the post that Robert Heineken held for many years. And I think Catherine Opie, who's also in the show, was a UCLA professor. So there's sort of a movement that was occurring in Los Angeles that they were all part of. So it's nice to have them all in the show together.
Yeah, and all of them are, in some way, you'd have to call them realists.
That's true,
and,
yeah.
And Catherine Opie, she shoots images from television, yeah? So she's basically, and that lends itself to the sort of documentary idea. It's an exploration, in a way, of the notion of the documentary.
Absolutely, and that was from a period where she was doing a huge project called In and Around Home. Mm-hmm. So she was mostly taking pictures of herself, her partner, her child, her backyard, but then of course, the television is in our homes, mm-hmm. and it's a constant reminder of the outside world, even though we seclude ourselves within the four walls of our homes, that the real world comes in through our television. And that was, I felt, very obvious in her pictures of George Bush and the Pope and Terri Schiavo and things that were on the news during the time she was making the project.
Yeah, there's something about the Polaroid shot, even though it's about the here and now, and it lends itself to an idea of the documentary. When you look at a Polaroid, it's not a great medium for depicting reality just straight on, is it?
Yeah.
For one thing, there's the instability of the color. But it's not just the instability of the color. So that's what interests me about people like Welling and Opie, mm-hmm. and that they're striving to get a grasp on visible reality, and they find ways of doing it, really despite the medium. Almost.
That's right, yeah. And there are other photographers in the show that take pictures off the television the way that Opie did. And some of them did it before there was such a thing as a VCR.
Uh-huh.
It was the only way to freeze an image was to take a picture of your TV.
Yeah. And all those images, I mean, especially if you were taking pictures of television in the old days, before videotape, you were taking something that was completely evanescent. It was there and it was gone.
That's right. And then it would disappear.
If the medium doesn't lend itself necessarily to the direct capture of reality, it does sometimes lend itself to abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
And Walker Evans himself seems to have seen this. I mean, his images seem more abstract in some ways than many of the other artists.
That's certainly true.
Maybe among the most abstract, even though they're of objects.
They're right from nature. That's right. A lot of the abstraction ends up being more contemporary artists who have come to this material later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think at that point, they've been completely liberated from this idea that photography is a record of reality.
Yes.
And also there's a trend towards abstract photography.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a real freedom with that. In fact, painting on the image might be just to basically make an abstract image, even though underneath there somewhere there is a photograph. So there's a number of those from the last 10 or 15 years in the exhibition.
I wanted to mention the catalog, which strikes me as something of a labor of love. It's really a beautiful catalog, produced and thought through. I can see a lot of design work has gone into it.
Yes.
You know, I'm an art librarian. Most of the art books that come across my desk aren't so nicely designed.
It was designed by Laura Lindgren, mm-hmm. who I spotted because she recently did the exhibition catalog for a show at Bowdoin called Hello Nature of William Wegman's work. And I loved the design of that.
Yeah.
And so we got her to take part in this book.
Oh, great. And that's and she works under the umbrella of Prestel, was a publisher?
She's freelance, but she does a lot of Prestel's books, yes.
Okay. And I know there's no such thing, you know, in ordinary terms, of a Polaroid negative or transparency, as we talked about. These are one-of-a-kind objects. So did you have to then reshoot all the works in the exhibit from their originals with digital cameras in order to reproduce them?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And in some cases, they're actually scanned. The actual image is put on a drum scan. I know we did that for the Dash Snow pictures. Lots of them, we brought them down to our own studio in our building to photograph the originals.
Yeah.
So, yeah, then we actually do have a negative, for the first time, a negative of the image that was created.
So you have in the catalog your essay and the essay by Peter Buse. And then also you have artist statements and you have a section of works. Is everything
almost
in the
everything
show,
in the show is in the book.
Is it?
There's maybe one or two omissions, but for the
most part
it's
everything
the same.
Is reproduced, and sometimes in its original size and sometimes in a larger format. And
there
was a design probably choice for that, yes?
Yeah. We just wanted the work to look its best in the book. So whatever size that was, we went with it.
Yeah, great.
The artist statements were important to me because I felt as though I was making a certain assumption by saying that these artists have been inspired by the Polaroid technology. But I really wanted to hear it in their own voices.
Mm-hmm.
What effect did Polaroid technology have on their decision-making, on their work itself, and why it was important to them to gravitate towards this particular technology? And I thought they all did a great job in expressing that in very different ways. Some of them have a lifelong relationship with the material. Some of them just dabbled in it here and there. But each of them did have a specific reason why Polaroid was important to their work.
Yeah, and you have quite a number of statements in the...
Yeah, I think they're 12. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you take these over the phone, or did you go see people, or did you write?
There's one that I took over the phone, and that was Chuck Close, because he said he's just not a writer, but he's a very eloquent speaker, and I barely had to clean that up to make it sound like a written statement.
Yeah.
And all the rest of the artists did their own writing and submitted it to my editor. And there wasn't a lot of editing for theirs either, actually. Yeah. They were quite eloquent about their relationship.
Yeah, they're very thoughtful, all of them, I think.
I think they might have already had this in their minds, and it was just a matter of putting it down on paper.
Yeah. And some are kind of funny. Who is it that writes about Andy Warhol's crappy, I forget the word that he uses.
I think it's kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
He said, I'm looking for beautiful images, and Warhol was not. That wasn't his idea.
Yeah. So can you tell me, I mean, apart from gathering the artist statements, what went into your research? Because our program is to some extent about libraries and the research process. And I know these things, when a museum puts an exhibition on, it doesn't just do it to show the images, but it does it in a sense to document the images, which is what the catalog is about. And a lot of thought and work, research goes into an exhibit, doesn't it?
A lot of research. And I'm very grateful because actually the Andy Warhol Foundation gave me a grant to do the research as well. So I was really able to delve into the idea because my original idea was just to do a Polaroid show. And it wasn't until I took a trip to Switzerland and looked through close to 10,000 Polaroid works that were in the collection.
And that's where the Polaroid collection is.
Now moved to Vienna. I'm glad I got to see it when it was at the Musée de Lycée in Lausanne because they were very helpful with it, and the director at the time, Bill Ewing, is a photography person. It's a photography museum, and they really understood where I was going with this, and they gave me total freedom to look through these images. And it just became clear to me that the exhibition needed to be about experimentation because that was the best work that was in that collection. Then I did a lot of interviewing. I interviewed Barbara Hitchcock. I interviewed Jerry Thompson, who was Walker Evans' assistant late in his life when he had his camera. He's actually the owner of the camera that's in the exhibition. I interviewed various artists and people connected to the Polaroid Corporation. John Reuter, who's a wonderful resource because he worked for the Polaroid Corporation on and off for 40 years. And he still runs the 20 by 24 studio in New York today. Hugely knowledgeable. He's like just a font of information. So these interviews were transcribed. Much of that went into the research for my essay and really just going from studio to studio. And what I often do to find artists is I ask other artists. So I'm in one artist studio and they say, oh, you know who else was using Polaroid? You might want to check this person out. Visiting private collections, visiting public collections. So there was quite a bit of travel and sort of just digging through people's archives to find the material for this. The Harvard Baker Library is where the Polaroid archives exist. So all of the papers, all of the information on the marketing of the Polaroid Corporation, they're all at this wonderful library at Harvard. If you can make an appointment and go and visit the material, all the pictures, everything's there. And then the MIT Museum itself has acquired all of the ephemera. So prototypes for the cameras, Edwin Land's desk chair, I mean, all kinds of objects. And so a lot of this resides in the Boston area, the Boston-Cambridge area, and it's there. So, and I think there are a handful of people, including Peter Buse, who wrote for the catalog that are digging through that material now.
The nice thing about research is as you conduct this research, you become a resource yourself for other people who are going to be working in Polaroid in the future. I'm sure you're going to get telephone calls.
I hope so. Yeah. I'd love to share my knowledge. In fact, there's an exhibition that's coming to the MIT Museum in 2015 or 16, they think, and they've already contacted me to basically help them along in terms of their research.
Great. So, you know, one thing that strikes me about the show, in some respects, it's about classical modernism, the technology itself. Edwin Land, he comes out of that world. You know, he hires Rand Charles Eames as publicity people, basically. But, you know, he's interested in that kind of design. And when you look at the camera, you're looking at a just classic icon of modernism. And then the exhibition extends out with artists that are contemporary. And certainly, you know, through the period of postmodernism, but there isn't a break. There's the same excitement about this technology and the art that comes out of it that 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 isn't challenged at all.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this allows for a different take on, you know, the split with modernism.
Possibly. I mean, a lot of the work in the show is very formal.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, as I mentioned, there are some more conceptual works, a handful of works that come from a concept first.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of work that's very much about formalism.
Yeah.
And I think that because this is about the technology, it's a show that really grows from the technology, it is sort of grounded in this idea of formalism, mm-hmm. which is connected to modernism.
Yeah,
I think that's true.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank you, Mary Kay, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your exhibition, The Polaroid Years, Instant Photography and Experimentation, up at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center through June 30th.
That's right. Yes. Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, it's been great. So.